We would like to acknowledge that the land which we are gathered on today is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Nation, specifically the Chippewa Tri-Council, comprised of the Chippewas of Beausoleil, Rama, and Georgina Island First Nations, and more recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River First Nation. Ontario is covered by 46 treaties and other agreements and is home to many Indigenous nations from across Turtle Island, including the Inuit and the Métis. These treaties and other agreements, including the One Dish with One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, are agreements to peaceably share and care for the land and its resources. Other Indigenous nations, Europeans, and newcomers were invited into this covenant in the spirit of respect, peace, and friendship. Most of us have come here as settlers, immigrants, or newcomers in this generation or generations past. We are all treaty people. Every day, we are mindful of broken covenants, and we strive to make this right. We commit to collaborating based on the foundational assumption that Indigenous peoples have their power, strength, and competency to develop culturally specific strategies for their communities. We are dedicated to honoring Indigenous self-determination, history, and culture, and are committed to moving forward in the spirit of reconciliation and respect with all First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Beyond the Stethoscope, the podcast where we delve into the heart of hospice palliative care. My name is Lori Gill, and I am the education specialist at North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network, and I will be your host today as we explore the topic of living with Parkinson's at end of life. With us today is a remarkable guest who brings valuable perspectives and expertise to our discussion. Kathy McEwen, who is a palliative pain and symptom management consultant, has dedicated her career to understanding and advocating for compassionate care approaches for patients and their families. Thank you for joining us today, Kathy.
Good morning, Lori. It's nice to be here. This morning, I have decided I'm doing a journal article, and I'm going to be speaking on end-of-life care of hospitalized patients with Parkinson's disease. This article is from the Aging and Neuroscience Journal. It was originally published on September the 6th, 2023, and there are numerous physicians involved in this article. There was Sakai Bansali, Eklis Asaid, Gerald Ritzi TU, Namishi Mandava, Claire Sonneborn, Olivia Hoag, Benjamin L. Walter, and Renato V. Samala, and Adam Margolis. They are all out of two Cleveland Clinic, Ohio hospitals from the Institute for Neurosciences at St. Luke's Medical Center in Quezon City, Philippines, University of East Raymond Magsaysay Memorial Medical Center in Quezon City, Philippines, and the Department of Palliative and Supportive Care, Cleveland Clinic, Cleveland, Ohio.
Can we discuss the introduction to this article?
Sure. First of all, I just sort of want to go back and let you know why I chose to speak about this. Palliative care in hospital for people with Parkinson's disease. I've seen in the past few years a few patients who have been in, and many of the issues that happened for them in hospital actually presented themselves in this article and in numerous other articles that I've read. And so therefore, it's not just that we do it wrong anywhere, it's happening globally. Pretty much the only country that really has it focused or together is the United Kingdom in Britain. And the other country very closely behind it would be Canada. I would say that we have a fairly good understanding of things as far as palliative care goes for Parkinson's disease, although I don't think we really get enough experience with it. So going on to the introduction of this article, Parkinson's disease is a slowly progressive neurodegenerative disorder. Following Alzheimer's dementia, Parkinson's disease is the second leading cause of mortality among neurodegenerative conditions. Parkinson's disease diagnosis is often preceded by years of non-motor symptoms. As the disease progresses, motor symptoms worsen, and the motor complications, including fluctuations and dyskinesia, may appear. Variable patterns of motor trajectories had been described in Parkinson's disease, but progressive terminal motor decline is common. Many motor and non-motor symptoms become treatment resistant in late stage Parkinson's disease. Due to the burden of these symptoms, waning response to dopaminergic therapy and cognitive decline, palliative care interventions are needed. Primary palliative care should ideally be provided by the patient's neurologist or family practitioner and should commence at the time of diagnosis. As time progresses and symptoms become more challenging, such as refractory pain, complex psychiatric symptoms, assistance with conflict resolution, and establishing goals of care, a referral to specific palliative care or consulting a neuropalliative physician becomes appropriate. In the inpatient setting, neuropalliative care can be administered either through inpatient palliative care services where patients are admitted for the purpose of managing their symptoms or through palliative care consult services that offer guidance and admitting team on effectively addressing the patient's symptoms. Hospice is a form of palliative care typically delivered by an interdisciplinary team, inpatient or home-based team that focuses on care at the end of life. A prognosis of 6 months or less is commonly required for patients to receive hospice care in the United States. So in Canada, for me, hospice care, I'm thinking more of the bricks and mortar building. They would probably be 3 months before we would accept anyone into our hospices. And as far as at home care, I mean, anytime, I would think maybe within the last year of their life, but usually I used to find that we would get referrals for patients in the community around 6 months to end of life. So accumulating evidence, including from a recent randomized control trial, suggested that integrating palliative care in the care of persons with Parkinson's leads to an improved quality of life and reduce symptom burden, which we already know as palliative care people. Towards end of life, people with Parkinson's often have complex needs and can present unique palliative care challenges. However, palliative care for patients with advanced Parkinson's disease and related disorders is underutilized and lacks awareness. Additionally, identifying patients approaching end of life is often difficult in people with Parkinson's. One study estimated that 17% of Parkinson's disease-related disorder patients in the U.S. died in the hospital as opposed to 4% dying in a hospice. There are no widely accepted guidelines to determine hospice eligibility for this population. Few studies, however, have attempted to identify predictors of mortality and suggested criteria for hospice consideration. The inpatient care of people with Parkinson's is complex compared to non-PD hospitalized patients. People with Parkinson's are more likely to require longer lengths of stay and experience delirium, infections, pressure ulcers, falls, syncope, and adverse drug events. Parkinson's disease has had poor control and complications related to Parkinson's disease treatment were identified as major clinical concerns. Inappropriate administration of dopaminergic medications can cause significant complications. Two large reviews highlighted the need for the guidelines concerning the management of hospitalized Parkinson's disease patients. There are no guidelines to aid neurologists, hospitalists, or palliative care clinicians in managing the symptoms of people with Parkinson's at end of life. Moreover, few studies have explored the experiences of people with Parkinson's at end of life. In one study investigating persons with PD who died while in the hospital, only 10% of patients had documented end of life care discussions with their providers, and 14% were referred to a palliative care team. In this study, they have decided to examine people with Parkinson's at end of life who died in a hospital setting or were referred to hospice care prior to discharge. They followed a clinical characteristics. One was their clinical characteristics. They aimed to describe their clinical characteristics. And secondly, trends of in-hospital medical and surgical management. And third, engagement and utilization of specialized palliative care services, ancillary services. And additionally, they reviewed the literature to summarize some strategies for managing hospitalized patients with Parkinson's near the end of life.
Kathy, what were the methods used to collect the data in this study?
Details on the study population and data collection were previously published by you et al. So in summary, that study looked at inpatient management of people with Parkinson's. Patients were selected by searching the electronic health records for past medical history or problem list of Parkinson's disease. The search included the admissions at two Cleveland Clinic sites in Fairview Hospital on main campus for the calendar year of 2018. Patients were diagnosed with primary Parkinsonism disorder and atypical forms of Parkinsonism, such as progressive supranuclear palsy and multiple system atrophy. Dementia with Lewy bodies or cortical basal syndrome were included. Patients with drug-induced Parkinsonism were excluded. The original data set contained 925 hospital admissions from 727 patients over 1 year. For the purpose of the current study, they looked at a data set for patients who met the following criteria: those who expired during the admission or discharge with hospice care, and those whose diagnosis of primary Parkinsonism was confirmed by a neurologist or a geriatrician. They had this confirmation done to further confirm the exclusion of secondary Parkinsonism, drug-induced Parkinsonism, and other neurodegenerative dementias. They wanted to make sure that they truly had a diagnosis of Parkinson's before they added them to the study. This group was referred to as the end-of-life group, and 47 charts were reviewed, and 35 patients fulfilled the inclusion criteria and were included in the final analysis. All other people with Parkinson's not meeting that criteria were included in the non-end-of-life group. So for each admission, the following data was collected, such as all their demographic data, their age, their sex, race, and ethnicity. They looked at nutritional status on admission and their length of stay. They followed, additional data was collected wherever available. So they looked at the days from discharge to death and the number of admissions to the emergency room visits in the year preceding their last hospital admission, code status upon last admission, changes to their code status during their last admission, caregivers, patients, discharge goals, rehab teams, impression of the disposition upon admission, and final discharge disposition. They looked at utilization of allied health services such as PT, OT, and speech therapy, dietitians, and palliative care team involvement. Also, intensive care unit admission and invasive procedures. The latter was defined as any procedure that required a general anesthesia, like bronchoscopy, biopsies, intubations, hernia repair, palliative ERCP, nephrostomy tube placement, percutaneous endoscopy gastrostomy, so a PEG tube insertion, and advanced PD therapy management. Also, they looked at deep brain stimulation, levodopa intestinal gel, and the severity of malnutrition was graded based on the nutritionist or the dietitian's evaluation, assessing a composite of subcutaneous fat loss, muscle loss, and functional capacity. With regards to code status, do not resuscitate, and comfort care is defined here as no cardiopulmonary resuscitation effort or intubation and the provision of comfort care. This data was extracted via manual chart review by two authors. Medication information was also reviewed, including the levodopa equivalent daily dose, deviation from the levodopa equivalent daily dose during admission, and administration of contraindicated medications. They searched for contraindicated medications, including the following: typical antipsychotics like chlorpromazine and haloperidol, and secondly, atypical antipsychotics like risperidone and olanzapine. They have listed about 10 other antipsychotics here, but I won't go through all of those. They also spoke to antiemetics like metoclopramide and prochlorperazine and promethazine. So they looked to see, these are all medications that are anti-dopaminergic and probably should never be given to these. Well, they are contraindicated, should not be given to people with Parkinson's disease. And so they checked the charts to see how often that had happened. So pretty much this was pretty much what they did in looking at all of these patients with the medications. So those were the areas that they looked at in their methods. The experience of an inpatient with Parkinson's at end of life. So only 46% received a palliative care consultation. Speech therapy, nutritionists, and physical or occupational therapists were involved in their care. About 51% of these patients saw these other disciplines. Hospitalizations in the year preceding death were frequent, with a median of 4 admissions. Nearly half of those patients, 49%, in the end-of-life cohort underwent invasive procedures, including intubation, nephrostomy tube placements, bowel surgery, biopsies, bronchoscopies. 49% of the patients received ICU-level care during their admission, and 77% of these patients had a full code or a presumed full code status on admission, and 23% had a DNR CC code status, that is a comfort care code status. During their hospital stay, code status was changed to a DNR for all the full code, presumed full code patients, except for one patient. At the time of admission, disposition goals as determined by the family or patient preference and by admitting providers were explicitly stated for 23 patients, respectively. 20% of the patients' families expected a discharge to a rehabilitation or a skilled nursing facility, while 31% of them expected a discharge to home. Eventually, the large number of patients were discharged to a hospice facility on inpatient or an inpatient hospice, 1% of those, and followed by home with hospice care, 37%. 8 patients, 23% of them, died in the hospital. Among the Parkinson's people with Parkinson's at end of life, they compared those who expired in the hospital versus those discharged to hospice care. The average age was 82. Their Parkinson's duration and median was all sort of added up through a Charlson comorbidity score. They were relatively similar between the two groups. The group of patients that expired in the hospital had a higher percentage of invasive procedures and ICU admissions compared to the hospice group, of course. The hospice group was more likely to receive a palliative care consult. And the transition from full code for both groups occurred at a median of about 5 days after admission. Unfortunately, death occurred at a median of 0 days from the transition to comfort care for patients that expired in the hospital. Out of 27 patients that were initially full code, 6 passed on the same day the code status was changed. The trends in inpatient medication administration for these people. So with regards to medication administration trends, both groups were subject to frequent levodopa equivalent daily dose deviations and underdosing from their home regimen while being an inpatient. 85% of these hospitalizations in the end-of-life group involved at least 1 day of levodopa equivalent daily dose deviation, and the largest levodopa, and I'm just going to call this LED, LEDD, deviation was higher for the end-of-life group. But missed doses were infrequent in both groups. 85% of the admissions of these patients in the end-of-life group had LED. In the end-of-life group, 80% of the admission had at least 1 day of levodopa underdosing. 10% had at least 1 day of levodopa overdosing. So the median number of missed doses of levodopa was 1 in both of the end-of-life and non-end-of-life group. The frequency of contraindicated medications administration was 11% in end-of-life group and 9% in the non-end-of-life group. Both groups received contraindicated medications for a median of 2 days during their hospitalization. It was haloperidol and olanzapine were the most frequently administered meds in both cohorts, while metoclopramide was never given in the end-of-life group. Patients in 21% of hospitalizations in the non-end-of-life group received it during their stay. Among patients in the end-of-life group, 3 had pre-existing advanced therapies. 1 patient had a levodopa intestinal gel pump. placed in situ was which was not actively used due to malfunction, and two had an active deep brain stimulation device placed. One of them died acutely due to intracranial hemorrhage, presumed unrelated to the device. Although deep brain stimulation, you can develop an intracranial hemorrhage from having one placed. The other patient had an active stimulation upon transfer to hospice, and the admitting hospitalist team followed the hospice team's advice to maintain the device on. So they do, I'll talk about that a little bit later, about DBS. The population of people with Parkinson's at end of life had a median interval of 37 days separating their admission to death. Despite being older, having multiple comorbidities, and having frequent admissions in the last year of their life, the majority of patients did not receive a palliative care consultation. During their admission, invasive procedures were frequent, and admission to ICU was not uncommon. At the time of admission, patients and families and providers' expectations on disposition and goals were not aligned, and the majority had a full code, presumed full code status. Most patients were eventually discharged to home or inpatient hospice, and when code status was changed, it occurred at a similar median number of days in the hospice versus inpatient expired population group. Other findings suggest a low utilization rate of palliative care resources. Discussion of goals of care, involvement of palliative care services were delayed. It was observed that more often in the group that expired in the hospital, which also received more invasive care, our findings are in line with prior study, which emphasized the underutilization of palliative care resources for people with Parkinson's at end of life. Earlier, basically, the present study did not assess directly, though, about advanced care planning, although they did look at some other studies that chose to believe that people with Parkinson's were reported to vary with having been discussed with their primary care physician or a palliative care person or even the neurologist, that at least 68 to 95% of these people had had advanced care planning discussions with their primary care physicians or neurologists. But the present study, this paper, this discussion here, did not assess that directly, though the rate it postulated to be much lower than this, given that the majority of patients at end of life had full or presumed code status upon their last admission. And similar findings were seen in another study, which described that advanced care planning for many patients with Parkinson's disease started as a response to a crisis event, you know, probably an aspiration pneumonia or a fractured hip and ending up in hospital. And that would be the first time they had any kind of discussion about it, would have been in hospital. In addition to frequent admissions over the last year of life, the majority of patients in the end of life group were found to be malnourished and had several comorbid conditions. And in agreement with other studies showing that recurrent hospitalizations and emergency department visits increased with the longer disease duration. Some of these factors are among the suggested criteria for triggering a hospice referral. The trends should be noticed and could be considered as red flags triggering the initiation of advanced care planning conversations and or referral to a palliative care program resources. And in summary, inpatient retrospective study of people with Parkinson's highlights that the areas of concern which may affect the quality of life of people with Parkinson's in their last days. There is unmet need to expand advanced care planning discussions, particularly in the outpatient setting. More work was found to be needed to raise awareness of inpatient teams managing people with Parkinson's regarding the unique but common challenges facing people with Parkinson's with advanced disease and their vulnerability to certain medication omissions, administrations, and the value of involving specialty palliative care and or movement disorder services. Future prospective studies were needed to assess people with Parkinson's in the outpatient inpatient setting, aiming to assess the integration of movement disorders and palliative care services and embracing the recognition of those who might benefit from earlier facilitation such resources. Like these movement disorder people clinics, the movement disorder clinics We have lots of those around in Toronto area, and they are the people who pretty much follow these people palliatively. They do all of their ESAS scoring with them. They're also very instrumental in allowing the in speaking with the neurologist or the neurologist that's involved with that movement disorder clinic to help to assess in increasing a dose or thinking about deep brain stimulation. They can help the neurologist know where to place those electrodes in the brain and have a lot of those conversations with the client about advanced care planning. They do a lot of that at these movement disorder clinics. So, and I feel like in Ontario that we're pretty advanced with that.
What are some of the barriers in hospital that contribute to underutilization of palliative care?
There are really any guidelines when specialty palliative care may be needed for people with Parkinson's. It is a complex symptom management and challenging discussions regarding end-of-life care and advanced care planning. But that being said, there are several barriers that contribute to the underutilization of palliative care for people with Parkinson's, underestimating their emotional impact of being diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. There's insufficient time allocated for advanced care planning. There's a lack of clear responsibility of the roles in introducing palliative care, and limited resources, high workloads, and limited communication between healthcare services are some of the most common barriers identified to contribute to the underutilization of palliative care in this population. Neurologists often inform people with Parkinson's that they will die with Parkinson's disease, but not from it. While it is a chronic condition, the age-adjusted mortality ratio is higher in this population, and the leading cause of death are related to complications of Parkinson's disease. Like, there is really no to help, like palliative care, there is no consensus guidelines to help identify people with Parkinson's who would benefit from hospice care. However, a number of experts have suggested recommendations to guide the transition to palliative care. So Goy et al. Suggested that weight loss and shifts in the dopaminergic medication prescription trends reflecting the medication benefits no longer outweigh the side effects risk might be important factors signifying the need to consider hospice referral. There is, in addition to identifying potential candidates for hospice, it is important to explore patients' and families' goals and wishes and make sure to ascertain if hospice is in line with their goals of care.
Okay. Kathy, can you speak about suggested symptom management for people with Parkinson's disease at end of life?
Sure. There is a lot written about this here. So for symptom management, so they break it down here into motor symptoms, pain, psychosis, and gastrointestinal symptoms. So people with Parkinson's disease, even right from the get-go, having nothing to do really even with the medications, will develop ongoing constipation and do need to be on a bowel regime. So there's a lot of talk surrounding that. But Parkinson's was broken down into two groups here. So they had a group A, which is considered their end-of-life group, and a group B, which is their, to me, it's all end of life, but they have broken this down. I believe this is for people who may be 6 months before end of life. And then they have a group B, which is days to weeks to end of life, and what they suggest you should do. So for people with motor symptoms, they want you to simplify their medication regime if necessary. It's really very difficult for people who are on levodopa. There's really not a lot of other alternatives to replace it. Here in Canada, it's called regadenoson therapy. It's a transdermal patch, and it can be titrated to, there is a tool that a physician can use. I feel that wherever this person is in the hospital, for instance, they need to be speaking to the hospitalist or their family doctor, along with that neurologist, to help them change them over to that patch. Although there is a lot of talk that this patch also can cause more distress for the person at end of life, given that it does have an increase, it comes with increasing hallucinations, deliriums at end of life. They talk also in this document about levodopa carbidopa ascorbic acid solution. It is can be mixed up by crushing the levodopa carbidopa 125 into 1 liter of water and ascorbic acid at 2000 milligram per liter, and then delivering that every 1 to 2 hour intervals just sublingually or via an NG tube, which I find highly unlikely here in Ontario that we're going to be using an NG tube. To me, that's not comfort care at end of life, so that probably would never be used. They also speak to some advanced therapies for motor complications could be considered for selected PWP patients. These include levodopa carbidopa intestinal gel and apomorphine. So I'm not really sure about the intestinal gel. I know that it is available here in Ontario and by pump. I have not seen it used. I know that I've seen it on a YouTube video for people in Toronto who are using it. Apomorphine, I did take a look at this, and apomorphine also is available in Canada. They ran out of it and it was discontinued a year ago, but now they have it back and it's in something called a Go Pen, but it's like greater than $5,000. So if the person with Parkinson's disease does have good health insurance, like private insurance on the side other than their OHIP, they may have access to it. I really don't know if it's covered by all insurance, private insurance companies, but it's highly expensive. But they also have found like it's been it's not even approved in the United States, this apomorphine pen, but it is here in Canada. There is insufficient evidence on the safety of apomorphine infusions. So we would never infuse it. It's far too expensive. We would never have it hooked up to a sub-Q pump. People also, for their motor symptoms, they use Tylenol. So if unable to take their meds orally, they consider orally disintegrating carbidopa, levodopa, which is not available in Canada. Careful use of transdermal rhodogontine patch can be used in select patients. And, you know, they should be consulting with the movement disorder neurologist about all of this. For hospitalized patients, they need to avoid delaying or withholding medications. They need to maintain effective communication between their care teams. In delirious patients, medications which may contribute to confusion, like amantadine or any anticholinergics, may be withheld. I'm not really certain about amantadine and if we're using that with these people in the community or in hospital. In group B, for people who have days to weeks left to die, if oral intake is possible, disintegrating the carbidopa levodopa tablets or levodopa carbidopa ascorbic acid solution can be used. If oral intake is not possible, careful use of the transdermal patch is an option, but only in selected people is what they're saying. So when it comes to pain for these people at end of life, they will have some dystonic pain and they can adjust their levodopa dose. They can consider other medications, adjunctive medications, but they don't really tell us what they would use for that. And if appropriate, to improve their on state. So for these people, I guess to improve their on state, to potentiate that a little bit, they might use an adjunctive, which remember what that drug is. Anyway, a lot of these people apparently do fine receiving for their pain. They have, actually, this is a chronic disease. So these people have all three types of pain. They have neuropathic pain. They also have nociceptive pain, their musculoskeletal pain. They have also nosoplastic pain. So their pain is treated with things like gabapentin for the neuropathies. It's also treated with their musculoskeletal pain. They can have ibuprofen or acetaminophen. They're not big on treating people with opioids with Parkinson's disease. They don't seem to have them on long-acting opioids or immediate-release opioids until closer to very much end of life or within the hospice area. They seem to back away from that. They want people to be, given that it's, you know, a chronic disease and they can live, you know, 15 to 20 years with this disease, and have this pain ongoing, they want people to use other forms to relieve their pain, such as using exercise or swimming, getting out and walking. They can use other therapies, like alternative therapies are also very important with these people. Non-opioid analgesics like acetaminophen and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are important. They do mention oxycodone here, but it's in the form of the naloxone, but they found that it was not really very useful, so they have never really pushed that. People in the group B who were end of life can use opioids at end of life. They do start them on immediate release opioids for that, probably not on a continuous pump, given that they are opioid naive, and given this is days to weeks till end of life, they're going to be receiving like maybe 1 to 2 milligrams sub Q, maybe every couple of hours, 3 hours. So it's important to pay attention to that. They can also have cannabinoids also have been thought to be successful in helping them with their pain. Yeah, when it gets back to opioids, it's really something that it's immediate release, or they can have it sub Q, but really paying attention to the fact that these people are very opioid naive. And then when it comes to psychosis at end of life, many of these people do develop a psychosis. They have a delirium. Many of them at end of life with Parkinson's disease have already developed dementia, which is part of that disease. The longer they live with the Parkinson's disease, dementia often is the secondary comorbidity, kind of sets in as part of the disease. And they do develop psychosis and delirium. They need to assess and manage their illnesses such as or causes of delirium. So if they are having a delirium, they're going to be looking for things like infection. And that's totally up to the families, whether they want that kind of treatment as antibiotics when you're getting that close to end of life. Maybe if they're months away from end of life, sure, we might treat with antibiotics, but end of life days to weeks, it may be useful, but I guess they could do a trial a few days, and if it wasn't working, then they would probably discontinue. They would consider discontinuing anticholinergics, of course, followed by their dopamine agonists. And that's what they were, COMT inhibitors. They are like a catechol inhibitor. And basically that is a drug that's given to people who are on levodopa. It kind of enhances or potentiates the levodopa to help it cross the blood-brain barrier more readily. So that is one of the adjunctives that I was trying to think of earlier when we were talking about pain and motor symptoms. If psychotic symptoms do persist, consider adding an antipsychotic. They suggest here things like quetiapine or clozapine. I guess if they're still able to swallow, these are medications that can be used. Quetiapine is probably the best if they're still swallowing. They do talk about another medication here, pimavanserin. It is an antipsychotic, which is kind of a cool antipsychotic if you can afford it. It also is very expensive. It's like thousands of dollars and probably would require you to have private insurance to get it. It is a medication, though, that they want you to pay for immediately when you pick it up at the pharmacy. You can't just go and pick up your drugs and pay a little bit. They want you to pay for all of it immediately. But it is a nice antipsychotic because it doesn't interfere with levodopa, and it's one of the newer drugs, but of course, very, very expensive and probably not very useful. It has to be ordered special here in Canada or in Ontario. End of life, it's a typical antipsychotics can be considered like your quetiapine, although you can't give that if people are no longer swallowing. It's not something that's injectable. So midazolam infusion can be an option in some of these cases. So that would be the go-to drug for restlessness and delirium. Gastrointestinal symptoms. An evaluation by the dietitian or the speech-language pathologist is indicated. In some cases, the multidisciplinary team may need to come in, like a gastroenterologist, to see this person. But I mean, in the weeks ending, getting closer to end of life, there are other ways they can puree their food, although they do speak to the fact that a lot of patients with Parkinson's disease refuse to eat pureed food. they would prefer to eat real food, chew the food so that they have that satiety rather than and take their chances on aspirating food. But also the, you know, speech language pathologists can come in and teach them some swallowing maneuvers and exercises that might be beneficial. And also domperidone, it comes in, it's oral, or it also comes in a suppository form. And it can be used for things like nausea, because we can't give things like metoclopramide or prochlorperazine or any of the drugs that we normally use as an antiemetic in the palliative realm are conjugate for these people. They also talk about using ondansetron, also can be useful. I also read that it may also assist in psychosis. So giving that as an antiemetic may also help a little bit with delirium. It's hard to know. It's an off-label use that they found. And, you know, they talk to the fact about, you know, doing feed tubes. And I can't imagine at end of life that we would be talking to people about having a feed tube inserted. These are things that maybe need to be discussed much earlier on, but unfortunately for a lot of these people in this study that were coming into hospital, it seems that a lot of these advanced care planning conversations had never occurred, goals of care had never occurred. So here they are coming into hospital and some of them are dying, and a lot of their interventions that maybe could have been beneficial are no longer beneficial for them and not likely useful for them at end of life.
So, Kathy, I've heard you mention deep brain stimulation several times throughout this discussion. Can you talk about that for us?
Yeah, so deep brain stimulation, it seems like it is something that can be offered to patients who are having issues with tremors and mobility. It's basically, I think, mostly to eradicate some tremors or slow them down at least. The movement disorder clinics, the neurologists there, it's very helpful to have these people involved, because when they do place those electrodes, they can tell where to put that electrode in your brain to help minimize those tremors. So what was interesting to me is, like in other, you know, diseases that we cover, things like congestive heart failure, you know, people have pacemakers or they may have, you know, an internal defibrillator on board. And we always want to make sure that these things are turned off or at death or before they die. And it's usually a discussion that has to be talked about as far as withdrawing care. And when they're talking to families with Parkinson's disease patients about withdrawing care, deep brain stimulation is something that does not need to be turned off. It can be turned off if the patient wants it turned off, but apparently many opt to keep them on because it eradicates their tremors. They feel better. And it's also a dignity thing. Like for a lot of people, you know, they've lost all of their, some of them have lost their identity. They've lost their independence because they can no longer care for themselves. They've lost it all. And so if they are still with it enough to understand, they prefer to leave the deep brain stimulation on. The thing is about it, what they say is that can offer some comfort care. So unless patients specifically document a preference regarding the DBS management, DBS should not be discontinued on the basis of living, you know, on the basis of healthcare providers to withhold or withdraw life-sustaining treatments. DBS may instead be considered comfort care, diminishing discomfort by alleviating tremor, rigidity, or medication-related side effects. So if the DBS alleviates discomfort with a more acceptable balance of side effects compared to other potential comfort measures, this limits any justification for device deactivation and may justify battery replacement in later stages of the disease progression. They also have, like, I think the battery can be recharged right there. You don't have to necessarily replace that battery. So in conclusion, what they found with this study and what I have read in many other articles and what I have also seen in hospital myself is that it sheds light on the complex and often challenging landscape of providing care to patients with Parkinson's disease. near the end of life. Study touched on the underutilization of palliative care resources for this population, despite the high burden of comorbidities and frequent hospital admissions in the last year of their lives. The majority of patients were full code, and less than majority of the patients were seen by palliative care. Patients who died in the hospital had a higher healthcare resource utilization, invasive procedures, ICU transfers, and lower palliative care involvement. The findings highlight the need for improved integration of palliative care, particularly in the inpatient setting, the delayed involvement of palliative care services with the mismatch between patient and family expectations and provider goals of care, highlight the importance of early recognition of declining health trajectories and initiating conversations about advanced care planning. It also highlighted that the complexities of medication management for inpatient Parkinson's disease patients. So frequent deviations from home medication regimens in both end-of-life and non-end-of-life groups included underdosing. Fortunately, given KDIP medications and missing medications for Parkinson's disease were uncommon errors. So that was the one good thing that came out of this. Additionally, efforts to develop standardized guidelines for palliative care integration, advanced care planning, and medication management for patients in advanced Parkinson's disease at end of life are essential to improve patient outcomes and quality of care. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy, for joining us today and for sharing your insights on such a deeply important topic. Your expertise and experiences are invaluable in helping us understand the complexities of living with Parkinson's at end of life. We truly appreciate your time and the work you do to support those navigating these challenging journeys. So thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Laura.